brought to you by Prescient Investment Management. Informed by science, guided by insight. Prescient Investment Management is an authorized FSP.
Welcome to Honest Money. We're doing something slightly different today because we've just come out of the medium-term budget, and I'll get into that in a bit more detail now. And it's kind of a seminal time for South Africa because there's a lot of questions about the South African bond market, about the ability of the country to handle debt. And especially that this debt kind of seems to be spiraling, and it's causing a lot of fear amongst South African and international investors. And so I think it's important between the October kind of medium-term budget, as well as the Feb 2024 actual big budget, that we see what's going on. And this is not my area of expertise. So I'm very relieved and very happy to have Reza Ismail, who's the head of bonds at Prescient Investment Management. Reza, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Warren. Always a pleasure. Glad to be on the show, as always.
So Reza, the ability of a country to raise money, to get money, and to borrow money, maybe is the simpler way of saying it, and then use that money, hopefully, to run the country and to grow the country, is done primarily through bonds. But we don't really talk about bonds a lot in investment markets, and frankly, I think a lot of financial planners and people who look at shares don't really understand bonds. So I think for our listeners, let's just start with that. What are bonds?
Sure, Warren. Yeah. So bonds occupy, if we can think of different sort of type of investments that carry with it different kind of risk return characteristics, right? So for example, if we think like something like a cash investment or money that you put on deposit, it's very safe. There's not a lot of capital fluctuation. It's a low volatility kind of solution, but the returns are also commensurate with that being so low in terms of volatility terms, and the fact that your capital is not really at risk. That would be a cash investment. On the other side of the spectrum, I think you mentioned something like a stock or an equity investment. So this is something where the prospect of getting quite an outsized gain or sort of an outsized reward is always there. But what comes part and parcel with that is you have to be able to accept and stomach a degree of volatility or fluctuations in the capital value of your investment, right? So bonds basically straddle those two worlds in some sense. So they occupy almost an intermediate space between sort of cash investments, which are sort of low return, low volatility, or shall I say less exciting return, low volatility, and a fairly racy world of equities. Bonds basically sit somewhere in between. So it you have the prospect there of both almost like an income-like return, like what you get on cash, and also you also do have the prospect of capital gains, something that they borrow sort of from the equity world. So it's an investment that aims to give you a somewhat intermediate kind of return for an intermediate kind of volatility that sits between cash and an equity investment. That's what it is at its very basic level.
So I'm if I'm buying bonds, I'm hoping to get a bit of a higher return than I would if I put my money on fixed deposit, and a bit more risk. On the other side, if I'm a share investor and I buy bonds, what I'm expecting is that it's hopefully not so volatile, not so rocky, and maybe the price for that is that I don't get as much total return. So, and I think that's an important point there that then I would get from the stock market, but hopefully that actually what you really want to do is put the two together. You want all three, right? You want some cash, some bonds, some shares.
Exactly. That's absolutely right. And that would be referred to in common parlance as sort of a balanced portfolio or a balanced solution or a diversified portfolio would generally have some proportion of equities, some proportion of bonds, and some proportion of cash. And maybe we can even extend this to those same asset classes also find a voice in the offshore space. So you can also talk about offshore equities, offshore bonds, and offshore cash investments. But generally, yes, that is the idea, to blend these asset classes together and effectively get an offering that is hopefully able to navigate different types of market regimes whilst in the long run delivering a fairly stable kind of return signature. That is the idea, exactly as you've expressed.
So now we're in a world where international investors typically look at South Africa's bond market and they would say, it pays a better rate of interest on the bonds than they could get, for example, on American bonds or Swiss bonds or something like that. So it can be an attractive place for a bond investor, yes, in South Africa, but also globally to look at getting better returns than normal. But that kind of seems to have changed in the last while, where we're not really seeing international buyers coming into the South African bonds as much as they used to. And so the question is, what's happening in our bond market that are we not generating returns? So when they look at our bond market, what's stopping them buying the bonds that they might have done in the past?
Yeah, that's an absolutely fantastic question. And I think that the common answer, right, or a very popular but erroneous answer that we get is that the reasons for that are located in sort of inward looking reasons, right? In other words, it's because of shortcomings and particular critiques, idiosyncratic reasons that pertain to South Africa themselves, to South Africa itself, right? That is at the heart of why foreigners are not coming here. This is actually incorrect, okay? And by far the biggest determinant or the biggest reason for why we see this reduced amount of appetite for South African bonds has reasons that are entirely global in nature, right? So you'd remember perhaps in some of your shows, I'm sure you maybe covered last year, this inflationary dynamics in places like the US and then the very aggressive monetary response by the US, in an attempt to essentially address inflation, right? So what has in fact happened, Warren, is that in their process of trying to normalize monetary policy in the US, right? In other words, in order to hike rates in the US to restore price stability to the US, what has happened is that short-term rates in the US, right, have increased quite dramatically, right? And this actually means that there's a heightened opportunity cost for a foreign-based investor, or let's just call it a US-based investor, to then leave the US, right, and shun the kind of 5% in USD terms that he could ostensibly get from a US safe haven deposit, and instead look outwards towards places like South Africa and Brazil and Mexico, Indonesia and Poland and all of these kind of high carry emerging market destinations. There's no need for that US investor to basically look outwards any longer. This is commonly referred to in sort of investment parlance as the carry trade. So if you remember, in the period post the global financial crisis, central banks essentially in places like the US, they reduced policy rates to near zero. Okay. So what that meant was that capital investors could effectively borrow at zero in the US, right? Take out money at a zero rate of interest, and then basically deploy that money in places like South Africa, Brazil, Russia, in these high carry emerging market destinations. This was a very popular thing called the carry trade. Okay. Now, what has now happened was that the entire bedrock of the carry trade has completely been eroded by the fact that it's not zero rates of interest in the US any longer, right? Now that US guy, if he wants to take out a loan, is basically going to almost have to pay 5% in USD terms, or alternatively, he's faced with the prospect of being able to exploit these very high deposit rates in the US itself. So there's no need for that investor to sort of look outwards towards these high carry destinations any longer. So that kind of dynamic has by far been the major explainer of why there's been this reduced appetite for South African bonds. The challenge, Warren, is that unfortunately this happens at a time that is coincident with certain idiosyncratic problems for South Africa on their own. So for example, reduced appetite by foreigners is also happening at a time that we are also facing quite a large fiscal deficit, that we are also facing large unemployment, that we are also facing load shedding, right? All these idiosyncratically South African things that happens to coincide with the time that the global landscape just makes it unviable for foreigners to want to play in South Africa. And unfortunately, those two get conflated and people draw the erroneous conclusion that it's because of some SA-specific reasons that foreigners are not here.
So if we were to weight this, we would say kind of 80 or 90% of the thing is that, it's global factors. And then the last 10 or 20% is South African factors. So if there was 100 million rand leaving South Africa, 80 million is leaving because of big factors, 20 million is leaving because of SA factors. And if SA was pumping and our economy was going well and our government was doing the best job they possibly could, we would still then lose 80 million, but not 100 million.
Absolutely right.
So I think it's important because I'm kind of, when you're talking in my head, what I'm imagining is that kind of interest rate in America is like a massive big vacuum cleaner. And what it does is it sucks all the money from the rest of the world and parks it in cash in America because that's perceived to be safe. And people don't need to then send money overseas to try and get a bit of a better return, which is perceived to be more risky than what they can put on the deposit in America.
That's absolutely right. And remember that the reason why those rates are so high in the US was because of, if we think of the COVID episode, right? So the COVID episode was sort of a historically unprecedented level of demand shutdown. I mean, you'd obviously remember the kind of level 5 type lockdowns we had here in South Africa, the streets completely empty, people scurrying around to, stock up on toilet rolls and things like that. So COVID was unprecedented. The monetary response to COVID, the initial response, i.e. of cutting rates, was quite unprecedented. And then where we are in now, circa March of 2022, the pathway out of that COVID response, in other words, the process to now hike rates again, that has also been unprecedented in the sense of its scale and its aggressiveness, its level of aggressiveness, particularly in the US, right? So now you had a problem where you had elevated inflation in the US, right? And the US basically having to hike in extremely high levels of increments and at extremely regular pace of increases to deal with inflation, right? And in so doing, a byproduct of that monetary response was exactly the phenomenon that I just described a little bit earlier, to give rise to that very, very elevated front end of the US yield curve, i.e. that very, very elevated possibility that you could have 5% or even in excess of 5% in a money market or money market proxy investment in the US, right? So it didn't come out of nowhere. It essentially got to that level because of the monetary response in order to sort of restore price stability or in order to basically get inflation back into kilter in the US.
And I think it's such a typical of economics, right? Things happen slowly and then all of a sudden they happen quickly. And then everyone's surprised because of the end, but actually the signals were there for quite some time. And, if we were alive to them, we would have known that it was coming. We wouldn't have known when, but we knew it was coming. I think maybe to jump ahead a little bit. So we've just come out of this kind of interim budget. They've got all these funny phrases, Treasury, for what they do. But I always feel like it's the half year budget and then the full year budget happens in February. So we've come through this half year budget in October. Not usually kind of a big event. It's not really something that gets a lot of news. People focus on the February budget, but because South Africa's got some real problems at the moment, that are partly self-inflicted, partly global, we're now looking at this interim budget. We did, all of us, look at it a bit more carefully. And I guess one of the questions I had looking at this was kind of, are we running out of money? Is this government just spending too much? And what are we going to do to stop spending? Because in personal finance it's easy. If you're kind of getting to the end of your credit limit, stop spending and you'll be okay. But I don't know, in the context of what's happened in that budget and the signals that we were given for February, is it good news? Are they trying to do things to stop spending, or are they just kind of carrying on?
Sure, Warren. So I probably can identify three separate nuggets or root paths in that question, right? So I'll try and address all three. So the first one is that South Africa does really have a dire problem with regards to the kind of revenues it generates, or in other words, which is a function of the kind of real growth path that South Africa is on. Now, Warren, you'd probably remember that at the time of the February budget, this is 2023, the revenue line kind of overshot somewhat, right? But this was a little bit of false flattery, because we know that that was only as a result of, again, somewhat global factors, but there was a massive push globally to this idea of alternative sources of energy and focusing on emissions control and things like that, which then meant that we had a boom in our platinum sector. Remember, platinum group metals, of which we export 70% of the world's production, are used in catalytic converters in vehicles, right? So it's a means of controlling emissions. So to the extent that people move towards this very, very green, very sustainable energy footing, platinum group metals become en vogue. So what I'm saying, why I'm saying this, is because the revenue line in February was flattered by the fact that we had a massive run-up in commodity prices up to that point, right? What I would say now is that in October, the current, or November, the current MTBPS, in terms of its undershooting revenue line, is in some sense a far more representative line of the kind of base revenue dynamics here in South Africa that has not been flattered by a boom in commodity prices, okay? And that reality is that we're actually sitting with a South African economy that is, in aggregate demand terms, on its knees. Okay, we are not nearly generating enough real growth to be able to have debt stabilization a little bit down the line. So what's happening now is that revenues are underperforming, and the onus of funding the deficit between revenues and ever expanding expenses, right? As you described it, if you think about it as a household budget kind of thing, you're almost earning the same type of income, same salary, even perhaps even a little bit of a less salary, but your expenses keep going up, right? So it means that you're going to basically be using more and more of your overdraft, right? Which at some point needs to be serviced and does not come free. Overdrafts are expensive, right? So that onus of funding that overdraft basically falls to the bond market, right? And that is why it gears sharply into focus every time there's a budget, or every time, you know, we discuss the medium-term budget policy statement for that matter, is that you generally enter a context of underwhelming revenues, of increasing expenses, and then what to do about the difference? Well, let's turn to the bond market and see if it can sort of bail us out, as it has been doing. The problem now, Warren, and linking this back to our previous comments, is that this is also happening at the same time as that you've got very reduced appetite for South African bonds. So it's all good and well that, you know, the bond market needs to do the heavy lifting in terms of funding that deficit. If there was healthy demand for the bonds, right? If there was robust local and international demand for South African bonds. But unfortunately, we're in a situation now where that foreign appetite is simply not there, okay? So that is a key thing. So it has to get to a stage where structural reforms are effected that enable us to enter into a better revenue path. That's A. B, there has to be some fiscal restraint with regards to, I mean, the Treasury and national government cannot continuously sort of appease labor unions by giving them outsized sort of salary increases, right, which are a natural strain on the budget. So the public wage bill is a major, major sort of elephant in terms of the expense line for a nation's finances, right? And unfortunately, we've not seen nearly the kind of restraint that needs to be there with regards to the expenses. So we have underwhelming revenues, expenses that keep escalating, and again, as I say, the onus of that then falls on the bond market. One minor area of difference, right? If we again hark this back to our household analogy, remember that effectively you've got let's just say a typical household has a particular level of income and a particular level of expenses, and maybe even your bank allows you a minor level of overdraft, right? So you can spend a little bit more than what you have to a particular level. But after that, it's pretty much game over for a household, right? You know, there comes a point at which it simply cannot now spend anymore, right? Now, unfortunately, and I will use this word very deliberately, unfortunately for a sovereign government, you cannot technically get to a level where you actually do run out of money, right? So I mean, this is quite a nuanced thing. So what could technically happen, right, is that the government essentially gets money by issuing bonds. Okay, so it sells the bonds, gets money in. Okay, but like we see in very many parts of the developed world, what could very well happen down the line is the government needs more money. There are no buyers for those bonds. There are no pension funds, no foreigners actually buying those bonds. So what happens is that the central bank itself of that same government, our own central bank, will need to buy our own bonds. So one room of the house prints the bonds. Another room in the same house buys those same bonds and credits the government's account with a particular amount of reserves, but let's just call it money for ease of explanation. So that is a way that is referred to as debt monetization. And that technically means that a country with monetary sovereignty, in other words, us being South Africa, for example, having our own currency rands, we can't technically run out of rands, right? That can't technically happen. What can very well happen is if this exact dynamic that I'm explaining now, i.e. debt monetization, this whole idea of the central bank buying the bonds of its own country, is that you will very likely then have runaway inflation, right? Because the aggregate of amount of money that is circulating in the financial system basically goes up, okay? So the problem, in fact, is that you get to a stage where if nobody wants your bonds, central bank has got to buy it, but because of that, the amount of aggregate liquidity or the amount of money churning around in the financial system increases and you have inflation. So that is, in fact, what will become the pervasive problem if we, in fact, enter into something like a debt spiral, where we continuously have to issue more bonds, no buyers, central bank has to bail us out, and you will have inflation. So inflation becomes the down-the-road problem of this idea of a debt spiral, and I'm talking about you know at its extreme form we get almost like hyperinflation, the kind of things we saw in World War II Germany and more proximately what we saw almost like some of the disaster tales in Zimbabwe not too long ago. I'm not saying, Warren, that we are anywhere near that. What I am saying is that if we cannot achieve fiscal consolidation, these are the moving parts that basically will happen further down the road, right? It's not that you will run out of money like a household, but certain things will need to be put in place that will ultimately result in very, very elevated inflation, and that will not be good news.
So I think, you know, kind of putting it, you know, back into a different context, we're looking at why are we looking at these October and February budgets so much more closely is, you know, we don't expect Treasury, we don't expect you know, the finance minister to grow the country. That's not his job. But what we expect him to do is to enforce discipline on spending. And I think for me that was the kind of the one signal, whether we believe it or not is the, I guess, the follow up question. But we did see a signal there that they are not the government is not kind of slacking down on trying to cut the spending or to control the spending, and then forcing that kind of discipline, you know, if it hasn't been happening to now, which is I think what they're saying as well, what Treasury is saying, then we're going to find new ways to force discipline. So for me, that felt like I can't say good news, but it just felt like a good signal to all of us. And then you know, all this noise, and I'm saying noise at the moment because it's not action, but the noise around kind of getting Transnet right, opening up the ports, getting the rails going, railway lines going properly, and then you know, continuing to sort out Eskom, that's the government's job in terms of trying to get the revenues going. That's part of getting the incoming money better again. They have to do a whole lot more, but gee, I think those are the things, when I look at it, that's why there's so much focus there. And the cynic in me, you know, just listening to you now, the cynic in me is going, I can also understand why there are elements of the ruling party and other parties that are so determined to kill the independence of the Reserve Bank, because they want the reserve, because if you've got an independent Reserve Bank, at some point they're not going to buy those bonds. They're not going to allow that hyperinflation to happen. And so you need to kill the independence of the Reserve Bank if you want to kind of spend forever. So it again reminds me that, you know, we need to be ultra vigilant that the Reserve Bank stays independent and that they continue to stay in their mandate.
Yeah, absolutely, Warren. I mean, like maybe just starting with those, your end comments, maybe just starting with those. I mean, if you remember not too long ago, in fact, it happened at the wake of COVID, in fact, just a month before that, where we received our final downgrade to take us into non-investment grade by Moody's. You know, this was circa 2020, maybe a month before the eye of the storm of COVID hit, right? And at the time, us in the sort of financial sector, we had quite a bit of interaction with the rating agencies, right? And essentially, we were quite puzzled in some sense, in the sense that we asked them, you know, the kind of reasons that you are citing for downgrading South Africa have been known for quite some time. So why is it that you took 6 months to effectively then, you know, do the deed, actually pull the trigger and downgrade South Africa? And we got quite an interesting answer, Warren, right? And they said that, look, in terms of the level of real activity, the level of growth in the economy, it's far too pedestrian. But this was something we knew. But what is in fact a shining grace of the South African landscape is the strength of its independent institutions, right? And that is what led to their reluctance to, in fact, put South Africa in sort of sub-investment grade, simply because, in some sense, we would be too strong for that remedial class, right, in some sense, purely on the fact that we've got a very credible and proven reserve bank, on the count of that we've got a very, very deep and liquid financial markets with good penetration of our financial sector in our own financial markets, right? The fact that we've got a very stable and mostly reliable judiciary, right? So the strength of our institutions are something that is the only thing that is allowing us to have some semblance of credibility in the international investor community. They all very well know that there's no growth in South Africa, that there's load shedding, that there's chronic unemployment, that there's many, many social ills. But what they do know is that you've got a tried and trusted and an independent reserve bank. Now, should it come to the stage, to your point, should it come to the stage where that last bastion of independence and credibility should get compromised? If, for example, people talk about nationalizing a reserve bank, right? I promise you, Warren, the kind of diminished appetite that we've seen for South African investments now, that will dwindle to completely zero, right? You can forget then about any foreign interest in South Africa whatsoever if it comes out that the central bank's integrity has been compromised. So that is one thing that there's a saying in many forms that sometimes it takes basically maybe 20 years to build a track record of respect and integrity that can disappear in the space of an utterance that takes a mere amount of seconds. You can destroy 20 years of track record with something silly that happens. So I hope that's really not the case here, because as I say, that is one of the last remaining sort of bastions of excellence that we do have here. And then on the sort of the government spending side, I mean, yes, there were some green shoots of positivity with regards to, okay, first of all, let's talk about Transnet. We know that there was no explicit allocation there was no explicit equity injection that was given to Transnet. There was a sort of an announcement that Transnet would need to produce a roadmap, or in other words, they would need to produce a plan that maps out how they would glean efficiencies with regards to everything that they are doing inefficiently at present. So we know that there was no explicit money given there. That was a good sign. The market seemed to appreciate that. And there are also other green shoots in place with regards to requiring sort of fiscal restraint with regards to curbing back hiring intentions on the part of public offices, which also was some green shoots of optimism. But so that kind of thing needs to increase. What was somewhat disappointing was, for example, the extension by another year of the Social Relief of Distress Grant. Remember, this was something that was meant to be a temporary, a little bit of a windfall to troubled households in the wake of COVID. That was initially extended to 2024, i.e. going to expire in March of 2024. But now it's been extended to another year. So it's now only will expire in March of 2025. So it's just been pushed, the can's just been kicked down the road. And that adds, you know, tens of billions to the expense line, you know, as well. Something that could easily, it's quite a thorny issue to try and, you know, sort of excavate yourself from so these kind of social transfers, because it almost becomes now a public expectation that you do it, right? And the risk is that you almost lose your voting base if you now try to remove that, right? But anyway, so that's a thorny issue. So that unfortunately is an area that we could say there could have been more fiscal restraint, but unfortunately didn't quite pan out that way. And ultimately, what do we need to see from the structures that be to get South Africa onto a better growth footing? I mean, that is really the main question. I mean, what will it take for us to get back to sort of 2% real growth? And Warren, it's really three things, right? At the moment now, there's this issue about very, very diminished fixed capital investment. The man who owns a pizza factory is not investing capital to build a second pizza factory because he's uncertain whether he's going to have the kind of electricity stability that he needs to run a plant of that size, right? So low fixed capital investment, low business confidence, and policy uncertainty. So it's that trifecta of things that need to be addressed. And without that, you really can't get any kind of springboard to stable real growth. And that is the crux of the matter. Even with a given amount of debt, which I agree is somewhat alarming, and even though notwithstanding the comments I made that you can't run out of money, but the real way to get to debt stabilization is to basically grow the economy, right? Yeah. You need, at some point you're going to have that revenue line that is not chronically underwhelming every single time, but we're getting to a point at which the South African economy is able to actually generate sort of lasting growth. And it's really that thing, fixed capital investment, basically policies, business confidence to return as a function of that, and getting policy certainty, right?
I'm going to cut it there because we're over time, and I think that's a very nice place to end, because we can see what needs to be done and what we can watch out for in terms of policy decisions that go for that, and equally what to watch out for in terms of the negative. So I think it's a really good place to go. I think it's our record longest podcast ever. Thank you so much for your time, Reeza. It was great. I really enjoyed it, and I certainly learned a lot. And we're going to need to touch base again, I think, after the February budget to figure out if things went well. Appreciate your time.
Absolutely. Always a pleasure. Thank you, Warren.
Brought to you by Prescient Investment Management. Informed by science. Guided by insight. Prescient Investment Management is an authorized FSP.